The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Today we read from Smithsonian.com, as the May edition of Smithsonian has not yet arrived. Scientists identify factors that make people naturally resistant to HIV, studying key points on the HIV virus that are weak to immune system attacks could lead to new treatments or HIV vaccines. By Bob Rohrer, Smithsonian.com. Developing an HIV vaccine has been a perplexing challenge that has mostly resulted in failure. But now scientists have identified key factors that allow some people to naturally suppress the HIV virus, work that could lead to better vaccines to both treat and prevent the infection. Researchers believe they have identified crucial points on the virus's surface where the immune system can successfully attack HIV. The research conducted by the Ragon Institute, Ragon spelled R-A-G-O-N, Institute, a collaboration of various affiliates of Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is presented in a new paper published in the journal Science. It builds on a study of two small groups of people who are naturally able to control the spread of HIV much better than the average patient. What takes medicine forward is really learning from patients, says Bruce Walker, director of the Ragon Institute and senior author of the study. It's seeing something in the clinic that doesn't fit the usual pattern, like somebody who is doing really well despite being HIV infected, that identifies the outliers that ultimately are so critical to explaining the whole disease process. One group called viremic controllers, less than 5% of those infected with HIV, are able to hold the virus in their blood to fewer than 2,000 copies per milliliter for many years, sometimes decades, without using antiretroviral drugs. Elite controllers, less than half of 1% of HIV carriers, have even more potent immune control and are able to suppress the virus below the level of detection, 50 copies per milliliter of blood, using the standard test for HIV infection. HIV generally spreads rapidly, infecting and killing immune system cells and leaving a person increasingly vulnerable to common infections after about 10 years without antiretroviral treatment. Ragon has identified about 1,800 controllers over 15 years of searching worldwide. Previous research identified specific human leukocyte antigen, HLA, patterns, genetically based markers on the surface of cells that regulate immune system function, that were associated with increased protection against HIV. But those HLA markers only explained about 20% of the total effect. And while having a specific HLA increased the odds that a person could control the virus, it didn't help at all in about a third of the patients. Something else had to be involved in suppressing the HIV virus. The new research examined the structure of HIV itself, pinpointing the specific parts of the virus targeted by the immune system to try to explain how some people resist the spread of HIV. The Ragon research team tapped into the protein data bank, a databank of the three-dimensional structures of protein molecules, for information on 12 of the 15 proteins that make up HIV. Using mathematical modeling, they identified nodes where the greatest numbers of proteins link together to form the virus. The complexity of these physical juncture points meant that any changes to the links of these nodes would have the most significant effects on how the virus functions. HIV could mutate at other points to thwart an immune system attack without seriously affecting the virus's function, but not at these key nodes. Then the research team looked at where CD8T cells, a key part of the immune system, target HIV. It turns out that the CD8 T cells of most people take random shots at HIV, often hitting parts of the virus that can easily mutate to block the attack. But the CD8 T cells of viremic and elite controllers concentrate their attack on the linked nodes where the virus is least capable of mutating to blunt the attack. Ranking the nodes by their connections of proteins and the specific cells on the virus targeted by the immune system produced a network score. The higher the network score, the more successful the CD8 T cells were at controlling the HIV infection. HLA structure did not seem to matter. In the lab, the researchers created versions of HIV that were mutated at these key nodes and tried to infect cell lines, the same way the virus would naturally spread through a patient. But the mutation significantly impaired the virus's ability to infect cells and replicate. We believe these findings could have major implications for the development of T-cell vaccines, says Gaurav Geha, the co-lead author of the paper. Vaccine development is an area of controversy among HIV researchers because most HIV vaccine research currently focuses on antibodies, another major part of the immune system, rather than on T cells to generate immune protection against infection. If indeed this approach has created a better map of what targets to hit on HIV, it is still just a first step, albeit a crucial one. Next will be to find a way to generate and deliver the right CD8 T cells to those targets. But the science could follow the rapid progress being made to develop CAR T cell therapy to fight cancer. The Ragon team has already started work developing a vaccine based on these principles, which will first be used as a mode of treatment rather than prevention. If you tweak the immune system in HIV infection, you can look immediately and see if it's lowered the viral load. It's a real-time monitor of how the immune system is doing, Walker says. Then, once we get these responses, we'll stop therapy and see if they can control the virus, and we should know very quickly. Geha believes this network analysis approach will also work just as well with other pathogens, identifying crucial sites to target therapies and vaccines. The new research is a major advance forward, says Stephen Deeks, a leading HIV researcher at the University of California, San Francisco, who did not participate in this study. There have been hundreds of stories about how HIV controllers do what they do, but very few of them have resulted in what I would call actionable outcomes, things that we say, let's use this information in the clinic. If treatment can be developed to target the correct parts of the HIV virus, like viremic and elite controllers' bodies do naturally, then the long term of developing a vaccine for the virus may be possible. Now we have a therapy that we can potentially use, Deke says. And here's something a little bit lighter, a brief history of cooties, why a 100-year-old game is still spreading across our playgrounds, by Jane C. Hu, Smithsonian Magazine. Of all the germs kids are exposed to on the playground, there's one they freak out about more than any other, cooties. The word first appeared during World War I as soldiers' slang for the painful body lice that infested the trenches. It went mainstream in 1919 when a Chicago company incorporated the pest into the cootie game, in which a player maneuvered colored cootie capsules across a painted battlefield into a cage. The cootie's concept has been evolving ever since. The most familiar incarnation has features of a real infectious disease, even as it says a good deal about what six-year-olds think of the opposite sex. Every little girl knows that boys have cooties, and vice versa. One catches cooties by, ooh, touching. Shrieking games of cootie tag transmit the contagion rapidly. It can be treated with an origami cootie catcher, but it is better to be vaccinated. This requires a friend and a retractable pen. Your friend clicks the pen onto your arm while chanting, circle, circle, dot, dot. Now you have your cootie shot. Folklore archives and internet forum threads show that regional variations of the therapeutic regimen have emerged. In Louisville, the charm is line, line, dot, dot, Operation Cootie Shot. In Los Angeles, kids pinch, pinch in lieu of the dot, dot. In Hawaii, the process is known as Yuku Shot. To historians and social scientists, the cooties phenomenon isn't just child's play. Kids, after all, are their own semi-literate society with their own cultural touchstones, says Simon Bronner, a folklorist at Penn State Harrisburg, who has studied children's traditions. The purpose of something like the cootie shot, passed down from generation to generation, must be profoundly important if all these kids are choosing to participate in it, says Talk Thompson, an anthropologist at the University of Southern California who studies modern folklore. Play helps kids make sense of new ideas, experiences, and emotions, not to mention traditional gender roles. The cootie shot itself is part teaching tool, part coping mechanism. Bronner has observed the emergence of this form of cooties in the 1950s, when the polio vaccine became ubiquitous, and a spike in its popularity in the 1980s during the height of the AIDS epidemic. Nowadays, cooties also reflect other concerns, particularly physical appearance. An obese child, for instance, might be said to have cooties. There's a greater emphasis on body shaming, Bronner says. Like a real virus, cooties mutate, and they'll likely be around for as long as you have children insecurities to play out. When women had cooties, cooties weren't just for kids. As early as 1921, a dice game called Cootie was a favorite at wedding showers. Women competed in teams of two to draw the very bug that had tormented many a husband-to-be during the war. One woman threw a die, the other was the artist. A six earned the team a cootie body, a five the head, a four one of six legs, and so on. The game was still popular among brides in 1949. When a Minnesota inventor created a 3D version in which players built cooties from colorful plastic pieces. It became a big hit with children and is still in production today. That was by Jane C. Hu, a journalist based in Seattle. Her writing has appeared in several publications, including Wired and The Atlantic. Next, science figures out what women find most physically attractive, by Jamie Sedell. News.com. Shiny shoes, clean-cut clothes, well-groomed hair. Once all these artificial coverings are stripped away, what exactly about a man is attractive to women? A new study has revealed substance wins out over style, but it's probably not what you think. It's all about the length of their legs. A study published in the science journal Royal Society Open Science says evolutionary pressures have a strong influence on female romantic perceptions. Women are programmed to select healthy male specimens, and one good indicator of that is the proportions of his body. Researchers measured the body proportions of 9,000 men in the U.S. military. They used the data to generate computer simulations of an average male body. Scientists then manipulated this figure, making its arms and legs shorter or longer. It then presented a selection of body types to several hundred heterosexual women. The question ranked the selection's physical attractiveness. The results were clear. Women don't care about men's elbows or knees or exactly where they're placed, and male arms are generally sidelined. Their length relative to the male bodies had no effect on the women's pulse. But when it came to legs, hearts would race if they looked to be closer to half of the male figure's height. A little more, a little less, and the women's eyes began to wander. And their ideal is just a bit longer than the male average, the study says. This could reflect an evolutionary influence. People with type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and high blood pressure may have shorter legs, for example. Leg-to-body ratios that are slightly above the mean are associated with high socioeconomic status, good nutrition, and developmental stability. as well as biomechanical efficiency during locomotion, lead researcher William Skylark writes. The observed preference for LBRs that are at or slightly above the population mean accords with the idea that these LBRs signal the fitness of the prospective mate. The proportion of the arm, as well as where the elbow and knees fit, can also reflect the impact of disease. But heterosexual U.S. women don't seem to care. Next, smart news, keeping you current. For the first time in 200 years, Japan's emperor has abdicated the throne. Emperor Akihito has voluntarily passed the title on to his son, Crown Prince Naruhito, by Bridget Katz. 30 years after he ascended to Japan's chrysanthemum throne, Emperor Akihito stepped down from his position Tuesday during a simple ceremony at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo. The event marked the first abdication of a Japanese emperor in more than two centuries. "Today I am concluding my duties as the emperor," Akihito said during the ceremony, which was broadcast on national television, reports Tomohiro Osaki of the Japan Times. At the conclusion of his speech, the 85-year-old emperor wished for peace and happiness for all the people in Japan and around the world. As Akihito and his family watched on, a sword and a jewel, two sacred emblems of the imperial family, were placed on a table along with state and privy seals. The third emblem, a sacred mirror, does not leave its space in the palace. In a ceremony to take place on Wednesday morning, Akihito's son, Naruhito, will inherit the regalia, a sign of his assumption of the throne. In 2016, Akihito began intimating that he would like to retire, citing his age and declining health. The next year, according to Motoko Rich of the New York Times, Japan's parliament passed a special act applying only to Akihito and not to future emperors that allowed him to step down. A Japanese monarch had not abdicated since Emperor Kokeku, who transferred his title to his son in 1817, reports Reuters. When Akihito ascended to the throne in 1989 after the death of his father, Hirohito, he faced the daunting task of softening the perception of a monarchy in both Japan and beyond. Hirohito reigned during World War II, and though he later portrayed himself as a virtually powerless constitutional monarch, many scholars have come to believe he played an active role in the war effort, writes History. In 1945, 70% of Americans favored the emperor's prosecution for war crimes, execution, imprisonment, or exile. As the Washington Post's Yoichi Funabashi points out, Japan's post-war constitution reduced the emperor to a purely symbolic role, and when Akihito's turn came to assume the exalted title, he focused his efforts on conveying a message of reconciliation and humanity. He and his wife, the former career diplomat, Empress Michiko, traveled across Japan, making sure to reach out to citizens who had been hard hit by natural disasters, like the 2011 earthquake and tsunami that killed nearly 16,000 people in the northern part of his country. According to the Times Rich, Akihito also traveled to Asian countries that had been attacked or occupied by Japan during World War II. Though he avoided making outright apologies, the emperor expressed careful regrets over his nation's role in the conflict. The Associated Press's Mari Yamaguchi reports, "The era of Akihito's reign is known as the Heizo, or achieving peace. With Crown Prince Naruhito's accession at midnight tonight, the era of Riwa, or pursuing harmony, will begin." According to Osaki of the Japan Times, Naruhito has expressed his intention of emulating his parents' compassion and accessibility, saying that they always stayed close to the people in their thoughts. That was by Bridget Katz, a freelance writer based in Toronto. Her work has appeared in a number of publications, including NewYorkMag.com, FlavorWire, and Tina Brown's Media's Women in the World. More smart news, keeping you current. 17th century Bible stolen from Pittsburgh Library recovered in the Netherlands. The 404-year-old religious text was one of more than 300 artifacts stolen from Pittsburgh's Carnegie Library over a two-decade period by Milan Soli. In April 2017, a routine insurance appraisal of the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh's rare book collection revealed 321 missing items, including atlases, maps, plate books, photograph albums, and manuscripts, valued by experts at around $8 million. Since the news broke, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been on the case, recovering fragments and intact volumes worth an estimated $1.6 million. Last week, a 1615 Geneva Bible, similar to the one brought from Europe by pilgrims traveling aboard the Mayflower, joined the collection of rediscovered tomes. According to CNN's Lauren M. Johnson, authorities found the 404-year-old Bible in the possession of Jeremy Dupertus Bangs, director of Netherlands' Leiden American Pilgrim Museum. As Bangs tells Johnson, he purchased the volume from a seemingly reputable dealer in antiquarian books for inclusion in an upcoming exhibition on texts owned by members of Plymouth Colony. During a news conference, District Attorney spokesperson Mike Manco said that Bangs paid $1,200 for the Bible, now valued at closer to $5,500 in 2015. From a dollar figure sense, the Bible is not priceless, FBI agent Robert Jones said at the conference, but from a history perspective, it is priceless. Known as Breach's Bible for its inclusion of the term in the Genesis description of Adam and Eve sewing fig leaf clothes to cover their nakedness, the text was translated by English Protestants who fled to Geneva during the reign of Catholic Queen Mary I. Pennsylvania investigators first alerted Bangs to the Bible's questionable provenance in 2018. After studying the case alongside Dutch police, he agreed to yield the artifact to an expert tasked with bringing it to the country's American embassy. The FBI's art crime team took over from there, the New York Times' Karen Zarek reports, safely transporting the Bible to the agency's Pittsburgh offices. As District Attorney Stephen Zappala Jr. tells the Associated Press Ramesh Santanam, the FBI will give the recovered manuscript to Allegheny County prosecutors who will, in turn, return the book to its rightful home at the Carnegie Library. Last year, prosecutors charged library archivist Richard Priori with allegedly smuggling hundreds of artifacts to local book dealers, John Schumann, who then resold them to unsuspecting clients. Priori was the sole archivist in charge of the library's rare book room from 1992 until his firing in June 2017. According to Shelley Bradbury of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, authorities believe Priori and Schumann, a once-respected member of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, who formerly led the organization's ethics committee, conspired to sell cannibalized and intact texts, many of which the archivist simply carried out of the library and into the bookseller's shop since the late 1990s. Milan Soli is a Washington, D.C.-based arts and science journalist. She has previously served as Smithsonian's American Society of Magazine editor's intern and a Kiplinger.com editorial intern. We continue reading from Smithsonian.com because Smithsonian Magazine for May has not yet arrived. This story, the striking new artworks that follow Rockefeller Center's grand tradition of public art. Frieze sculpture, on view for just 2 months, sparks a conversation between works created more than 80 years apart, by Laura Van Straten, Smithsonian.com. Conceived by John D. Rockefeller, Jr., fortunate son of the oil magnate, as a city within a city, Rockefeller Center was to be a mecca for lovers of art, as he put it, in the heart of New York. He commissioned the installation of more than 100 permanent sculptures, paintings, and textiles around his 22-acre real estate development in Midtown Manhattan. Since it opened in 1933, artworks like the sculptures of Prometheus and Atlas have become landmarks and photogenic destinations on par with a popular skating rink in its core. Now through June 28, following a nearly 20-year tradition of mounting one-offs of monolithic, crowd-pleasing contemporary artwork, Rockefeller Center is hosting its most expansive and daring exhibition yet. 20 diverse artworks at once from 14 contemporary artists from around the world. The two-month exhibition marks the New York debut for frieze sculpture, an import from the United Kingdom with major contemporary art cred. And the artworks, some commissioned specifically for this show, create a palpable tension with the more permanent artworks installed more than 80 years prior. Although the exhibition has no unifying theme, a number of artworks are pointedly political, addressing power and inequality by being what free sculpture curator Brett Littman describes as about speech, about freedom of expression, about media, about the idea of images, and then the propagation of images, particularly historical images. That pointedness is a radical move in a spot that teems with tourists 24/7 during the work week, and during the work week heaves with crowds of corporate types who work for the financial, legal, and other commercial institutions that occupy Rockefeller skyscrapers. I wanted to think about art here very differently, says Littman, explaining how he chose and cited the artworks. Generally, the art placed here is monumental, with one large piece, usually at Fifth Avenue or at 30 Rock. Historian and author of Great Fortune, the Epic of Rockefeller Center, Daniel Ockrent recalls that John D. Rockefeller Jr. was not considered avant-garde in the slightest, even though his wife, Abby Aldrich Rockefeller, was a co-founder of the Museum of Modern Art. Jr. assigned nearly 40 artists the theme of new frontiers for the permanent pieces commissioned for Rockefeller Center, according to its longtime archivist Christine Rossell, who literally wrote the book, two, in fact, on the center's permanent artworks. These artists delivered with heavy emphasis on themes of America's greatness, its spirit, industry, values, assured prosperity, and divine providence. He was afraid to push boundaries, and when one of the most prominent artists, Diego Rivera, did by including an image of Vladimir Lenin in a mural, Rockefeller famously had it replaced with Jose Maria Sert's American Progress. His taste in art was wildly conservative, says Ockrent. He was a little bit backward. The project as a whole wasn't very well received by the critics of the day when it debuted. As the Gershwin lyric goes, they all laughed at Rockefeller Center. But of course, the art world, as is its nature, has continued to push many boundaries of taste, materials, subject matter, and so on, in the decades since John D. Rockefeller Jr. made his mecca for the art he liked best. Fortunately, over the past 80-plus years, Rockefeller Center management has been open to change and innovation, Rossell adds, which is what allows the place to be a vehicle for exciting and sometimes controversial exhibits. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.